Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. In spite of all the advances of modern medicine, there are still many mysteries. In 2009, 24-year-old Susannah Cahalan was a recent graduate from Washington University and was in the early stage of a promising career as a reporter with the New York Post. An unknown pathogen turned her autoimmune system upside down. A rare and difficult neurological illness left her with a series of bewildering symptoms, hallucinations, paranoia, catatonic episodes, foaming at the mouth. Over the centuries, people with similar symptoms were thought to have been possessed by demons. She was suffering from something called anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis. She is only the 217th person ever diagnosed with it. Ms. Cahalan's ordeal is chronicled in her book, Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. She joins me in studio. Also with us is Dr. Eugene Rubin, professor and vice chair for education in the Department of Psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine. Susanna and Dr. Rubin, thanks so much for being with us. Great to see you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yep, thank you.
What a story you have to tell. It's just an incredible one. Let me begin by asking you to describe that crossing that line between sanity and insanity, as you put it.
You know, that line I kind of attribute to the time I had my first seizure. And I don't remember having that seizure, so this is all recounted to me. But my boyfriend says, after that very violent grand mal, you know, shaking of the body, you know, blood coming out of my mouth because I had bit my tongue, I woke up an entirely different person. You know, I became violent, angry, actively hallucinating, paranoid. In a lot of ways, I can't even really reconcile that person to who I am now. It's completely different. It's a stranger to me in a lot of ways.
But there had been other kinds of symptoms that you had detected earlier but hadn't quite put much together yet.
You know, yeah, at first I just felt off. I didn't feel like myself. So I thought I was having a bad week or a bad month. You know, my work wasn't going right. I thought maybe, you know, I just had started a new relationship with my boyfriend. I thought maybe this is too much for me. I just felt moody. I felt tired. You know, nothing was, you know, shouting at me, you must go see a doctor now.
Well, let me just ask about the title, then we'll proceed, mm-hmm. because Brain on Fire creates a very vivid picture in my mind.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, actually, during the height of my disease, when I was actually catatonic, I had went from being, you know, hallucinating and psychotic to actually catatonic, my doctor figured out through this very simple but ingenious test that my brain was inflamed. So he could tell from this very simple test that my brain was inflamed. So he actually took my parents out of the hospital room away from me and told them her brain is on fire. You know, Susanna's brain is on fire. So that's where the title comes from. I think it's very evocative. And what's amazing is that my parents were actually relieved when they said that because of how terrible everything was prior to it.
But it took a long time to get to that point where they realized what was going on with your brain.
Yes, a very long time, yes.
Yeah. Give us some sense of the kinds of things you were going through in terms of attempted diagnosis mm-hmm. to get to that point where there actually was a firm diagnosis.
Well, you know, at first, I had numbness in my hands very early on, and about 2 months prior to my hospital admission, a month or two. And I thought – I was very concerned by that. And so I actually went to see a doctor, and he thought, I think you have mono. So that was the first thing I was diagnosed with, mono. Then I became – you know, my behavior started to change. I became moody and, you know, just not like myself. But I didn't connect the two. I didn't say, oh, I have this numbness and I have, you know, this kind of mood change. They were totally different things. And at that point, I actually Googled around and became convinced that I was suffering from bipolar disorder. And I was actually so thrilled to have that because I couldn't explain why I was acting so erratic, why I was so moody. And when I finally found kind of bipolar disorder as an answer, I felt like I have now joined this kind of club of creatives, and I had this great explanation for my behavior, and I felt such relief. So that was the second diagnosis that I got.
Wasn't there also a diagnosis of alcoholism?
Yes. No. So then following my first seizure, mm-hmm. I went and saw a very esteemed neurologist whose name I changed in the book, who kind of took one look at me, 24 years old, working at the New York Post, you know, young woman. And said, I think you're working too hard and you're partying too hard and just knock all that off and you'll be fine.
Gee, how presumptuous.
Yes, very much so. And I actually, you know, because most of this time I actually had to recreate because I don't remember a lot of it. I actually got my medical records, and I had told him that I drank about 2 glasses of wine per night, approximately on average. And he wrote down 2 bottles of wine per night. So that was quite presumptuous, I think, on his part.
Well, we want to talk more in detail about this, but I want to bring Dr. Rubin into the conversation. Dr. Rubin, how do you connect the dots between psychiatry and a neurological problem such as this?
Those dots are connected because brain disease presents as abnormal behavior. And sometimes that abnormal behavior, like in illnesses like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, we don't yet know the many changes in the brain that causes those symptoms. But increasingly, we're finding certain illnesses, disorders, like this very new disorder that Susanna's describing, we find that these disorders change the brain in ways that we're learning at the molecular level and at the level of how brain systems are connected. And so what this disorder is helping us understand is that psychiatry and neurology are in some ways coming together in terms of trying to understand what's causing brain changes that lead to very unusual behaviors, and whether we have those causes or not determines whether some people might call it a psychiatric versus a neurologic illness, but that's artificial. The changes in behavior is what's important, and the cause of those changes in behavior. And more we're beginning to understand those causes. And psychiatry gets involved when the behaviors are really erratic and hard to manage. And neurology gets involved when you have symptoms like numbness and seizures. And more the two disciplines are holding hands and working together.
So this is going to change the way you and colleagues look at patients in the future as a result of Susanna's book and her problem?
So 6 weeks ago, when I was invited to participate in a panel that we had at WashU last night, I knew very little about this disorder other than hearing it mentioned because it's so rare. And now it turns out not to be as rare. I read her book and then read all the literature on this, and it has caused our department to become very interested in what this disorder or similar disorders represent, and it is causing us to be vigilant of this area, to really push for more research in this area, and to also look carefully at patients presenting to our service that have unusual symptoms that suggest, gee, I'm not sure what's really going on here. Is this acute bipolar disorder, but then you don't have seizures? Is this schizoaffective disorder, but the onset was so quick, and there was numbness, and there were other symptoms? So the more unusual the presentation, the more clinicians will become sensitive to, should we look for this group of disorders that now has been described in 600-700 patients, and more so papers are coming out looking at folks with more typical psychiatric illnesses and finding a few percent of people with schizophrenia, a small, small number, and the cases of people with schizophrenia who actually have the same disorder that Susanna has, a few percentage of those people actually have this disorder. Most don't. But those few percent that have it have very unusual presentations with movements called catatonia or very disorganized behavior. So, yes, our antennae are now sensitized at WashU about this disorder, and I suspect that will become contagious around the country with Susanna going and giving grand rounds and the literature and research expanding on the knowledge.
I guess, Susanna, for you, there is that silver lining to this particular cloud, the fact that you're making a difference and probably will make a difference.
No, I mean, that's the incredible part of this whole thing. Yeah. You know, I always say, you know, when I was diagnosed, I was the 217th person to have this disease. And I happen to be a journalist and a writer. So, you know, it's a gift in a lot of ways to help people. And I've actually seen people get diagnoses because of my story. I mean, in a lot of ways, it makes it all worth it.
Don't you have to wonder how many people were prior to you and the 216 who preceded you with the diagnosis? How many people over the years were not diagnosed properly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the disease itself was named in 2007. Mm. So that just gives you pause and you think about so many people throughout history. You know, the King George, you know, the madness of King George. Apparently, they think that he might have had anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis. So if you go back through history, there are a lot of historical figures out there that you think maybe, you know, could this person have suffered from some kind of autoimmune encephalitis?
You say the name of the disease a lot more easily than I do.
But I do too quickly.
You've had a lot more practice at that. I had said to the doctor prior to coming on the air that I imagine there were people that were burned at the stake.
Oh yes,
as a result of showing the kind of symptoms that you displayed.
Think about the witch trials, and exactly. You know, I mean, there's so many times throughout history. I mean, even saints. You know, there's a hyper religiosity that comes with this disease as well. Wow. So there's so many fascinating. If you look back through history, I mean, it changed the way I look at everything, including history.
Yeah. I want to go back and go over some of the journey that mm-hmm. you took, but I'm curious as to how you feel today with regard to potential for relapse, for instance.
Well, there's about a 12% relapse rate. And when I wrote the book, it was 25%. So it's gone down considerably. It does, in a way, haunt me. I mean, it doesn't change the way I live my life or any way like that. But there is kind of the specter of a relapse that does kind of follow me around. But again, I don't change my life because of it.
But it's something that is in the back of your mind.
Yes. I mean, you know, when you're feeling emotional one day, you know, everyone goes through an off day. Sometimes I get a little concerned.
The doctor, I think she said in the book, and I'll just address this to you, that if that should happen, she would feel better about it because at least they'd know how to deal with it, which is encouraging.
Yes, absolutely. If an unfortunate event happened and there was a relapse, now the diagnosis is known. The treatments are not typical psychiatric treatments. They're treatments to combat the immune system, and her doctors would certainly have protocols at hand to help her get back into a remission should that 12% occur. So in a way, sensitization has been very good.
So that has to make you feel a lot better
approaching
it that way.
I have a great support system. If I start acting a little off, I think I have some people in my life who will say, go to a doctor right now.
Yeah. Welcome back and continue the conversation. You were just listening to Susanna Cahalan. She is the author of the book Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. By the way, she's going to be at Left Bank Books in the Central West End tonight at 7 o'clock. I'm sorry?
Wednesday.
I beg your pardon. Just another mistake from those. That's right. Anyway, Wednesday night, she'll be there at 7 o'clock. I didn't realize you were going to be here so long, but good. And Dr. Rubin, thank you very much for being with us. We'll continue with our conversation in just a moment. And we'll take your calls. If you're interested in learning more about the journey that Ms. Cahalan took, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can send us a tweet at STL on air or reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Susanna Cahalan, author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. Also with us in studio is Dr. Eugene Rubin, professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine. We had been talking before coming out for the program today about the difference in the way people approached you, Susanna. Once you were diagnosed, it was a little bit different when they thought that you had a mental illness issue as opposed to this inflammation.
Right. When I was in the hospital for the first 2 weeks, approximately, the major diagnosis, the differential diagnosis that I was given was schizoaffective disorder, which is basically a combination of thought disorder, like schizophrenia, and a mood disorder like bipolar disorder. And so they weren't presenting this to my parents, but it was in the medical literature, my medical records. And then when Dr. Najjar, who ultimately treated me and diagnosed me, kind of dispelled that notion that it was a psychiatric condition, there was a difference in the way that I was treated. I mean, before, and again, it wasn't overt, but it was subtle. The nurses treated me different. There was a distance there. There was maybe a little bit of a lack of sympathy there. There were veiled threats periodically thrown at my father in particular, and my mother too, about how they were going to transfer me to somewhere else that wouldn't have the high level of care that the epilepsy ward that I was on would have, which was basically a threat that they were going to send me to a psychiatric ward.
You know, I'm not sure where in the process this actually took place, but there was a time when you were hospitalized, your father was with you, and a group of young doctors came through, very young doctors, mm-hmm. and it was almost as if you weren't there, the way they were talking about you. Explain what was going on there.
That was actually after my diagnosis. So I was, and that is a different way that I was treated too. I mm-hmm. became almost this prized object, an object, not a human. And a young group of residents came in and they were kind of look at this kind of animal in the zoo, kind of look at this amazing case, because I was the first case at NYU Medical Center to have this disease or to be diagnosed with the disease. And so they all were kind of staring at me. And one of the people said, well, you know, in some cases they have to remove her ovaries. They might have to remove her ovaries. And my dad just shot up and, you know, his finger was out and he's like, you get the blank out of this room. You know, he was very angry about that. And, you know, I mean, it was just they forgot that there was actually a human being sitting there in the hospital bed.
Doctor, going to the stigma issue, which is something I'm sure that you're very well aware of. How do you deal with it?
Well, you know, it's very, very interesting going from another patient with schizophrenia to a fascinating patient with a brand new illness that residents and doctors get very excited about. One of the speakers last night sort of addressed this. And you know, it's very hard to sort of justify why would a person with schizophrenia, severe symptoms, have any less of a dignified approach to their treatment and diagnosis than someone with this exciting new rare illness. But it does exist, and part of our mission is to eliminate that stigma by understanding the brain much more. And the behavior of the house staff, the residents and doctors getting very excited about this disorder, that should occur behind closed doors in teaching sessions, but because it is interesting and exciting. But that's not the way that doctors should behave in front of families and patients, where professionalism is extremely important in terms of not treating a person as an illness, but being empathetic with this disorder. It's okay to convey, this is very interesting to us, but not talking as if the person isn't there, but making the person part of your team. And so it's a very interesting dilemma. Schizophrenia with similar symptoms versus a rare disorder that's just been discovered. In actuality, they're both as important and interesting, but we have a long way to go to get to that actuality.
Yeah. Susanna, pre-diagnosis, I certainly get the impression from the book that the people who were looking at you and trying to figure it out were really just shooting in the dark.
Oh, yes. I think, and I can't, can you blame them really? I mean, it's a very rare condition. And in many ways, on paper, I really fit the bill for a psychiatric condition. Barring the seizures. Really on paper. I mean, you had hallucinations, you had catatonia, you had so many paranoid thoughts, psychosis, you know, all of these things. On paper, really, there was really no difference between me and someone maybe with schizoaffective disorder or schizophrenia. So you can't really blame them.
What tell us about some of the kinds of tests that you had to undergo.
Pretty much every test you can imagine. I mean, you know, MRIs, CAT scans, PET scans, blood work all over the place, and then ultimately a brain biopsy as well, which was a very scary time as well.
And a spinal tap at
spinal
one point.
Spinal taps, several spinal taps.
What did all this cost?
$1 million at the end of the day, including treatment. I was the kind of – it cost $1 million to treat, to diagnose and treat me.
We've mentioned your father and you had mentioned your boyfriend. How were they holding up throughout all of this? I mean – you were not you.
No, it was terrifying for my family, you know, and they all played different roles, but they all agreed that they still saw these kind of glimmers of me, fundamentally who I was. They still could see that. The doctors could not, but my parents and my boyfriend, they could see that.
You don't remember a lot of this.
No.
Yeah. Do you have flash frames today of things coming back that you might not have remembered during this period?
Not really. I mean, I do remember my hallucinations. And that always bothered me. I didn't understand, why do I remember my hallucinations and I don't remember anything else? And I talked to some experts, and they actually said that many people with schizophrenia actually remember their hallucinations more than they remember parts of reality, which in a way made me feel better. You know, high emotional content, you know, the memory maybe just was preserved, whereas other ones were not.
Can you tell us, would you tell us what they were like, what you were hallucinating?
Yes. I mean, I had one very intense and actually very complicated and complex hallucination that my father had killed his wife, my stepmother. And, you know, I could actually see myself on the news. I can actually see myself and my father on the news. I could see it. I could hear it. Later, I had a hallucination that I could age people with my mind. So I could kind of stare at someone and wrinkles would form and they would get older, and then I could look away and then suddenly they'd get younger. And I remember, as opposed to the hallucination with my father, where I was terrified, I mean, so terrified, I felt so powerful in that role of, you know, a godlike, almost a godlike role. I felt that I control the world with my brain. So it was strange. They kind of ran the gamut of being terrifying and very empowering.
That, doctor, what she's describing here is something that is fairly typical?
Yes. Hallucinations can show themselves in many different ways, and delusions, fixed false beliefs that couldn't be true, can show themselves in many different ways. And psychiatrists, when a symptom occurs like an hallucination or a delusion, they don't try to interpret what the meaning of that symptom is. What they do is say, okay, this is the brain playing tricks. The input coming in isn't coming in from the outside, seeing things from the outside. It's coming in from the inside. And we need to try to help this person with those symptoms. And we see very unusual, bizarre symptoms in many of our psychiatric disorders. So we don't overinterpret what the symptom is, but we interpret she is having hallucinations, what's causing it, what can we do about it, and not worry about her father being in one and a grandiose delusion in another. It just sort of indicates brain not working in a certain way.
It sounds to me something like trying to interpret dreams. I mean, we may think we know what symbolism is happening when we dream, but we probably don't, right?
Well, we don't want to. So when a hallucination occurs, it may well be the brain, part of the brain that tries to understand behavior, is trying to pull in a lot of inputs. And it doesn't understand because things are broken. So systems of the brain are feeding information to the interpretive part of the brain, and the interpretive part of the brain can't figure it out. So it makes up solutions. You couldn't be my dad. Someone else is in your body. The Capgras syndrome is sort of the brain trying to understand why you're not feeling close emotions at that time towards your dad. So you're substituting someone must have taken over your dad. So we are starting to understand the pathophysiology, the underlying causes of hallucinations and delusions, but we got a long way to go.
If you would, tell us about that eureka moment. It's an interesting story as to how the doctor suddenly had that that insight into what was going on.
So I had been in the hospital for about 2.5 weeks at that point, and I had really – the illness had progressed in a way that I went from psychosis to catatonia. So there was a complete absence of emotion. You know, just if you saw me, you know, drooling, I could hardly swallow on my own. You know, it was getting very bad. And so Dr. Sue El-Najjar was called into the case, and he had this reputation for kind of being the man to go to when things didn't make sense. So he was called into my case, and he, first of all, his whole demeanor was very different from any doctor who had seen me before. He took a full history, and that history encompassed so many different things, including the numbness in my hands that wasn't really
Can I interrupt just for a second?
Yeah.
He's taking a full history from someone who's in a catatonic
state. From my parents.
Oh, okay. It was
yes.
all coming from
yes.
Okay. All right.
I mean, he did talk to me, but yeah. I was one word.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, yeah. Monosyllabic. But he was taking it mainly from my parents and my boyfriend, I think, later. But at that point, it was my mom and my dad in the hospital room. And he was trying to just get as much information as he could to get this a full portrait. And again, I don't remember any of this. So this is all recounted to me. So at one point, after doing a basic neurological test, and he's noticing she's catatonic. You know, when I do, you know, reflex hammer on her knees do not jut forward the way mm-hmm. they should. Her eyes are not. I say her. You know, it's almost like
it's
a different
person. Yeah.
My eyes were not constricting the way that they should. You know, all these basic things, which was showing him this is a neurological thing. And then he gives me a piece of paper and he asks me to draw a clock. So I draw a circle. And I remember from the from hearing it, I had to draw it twice because I couldn't – circle wasn't right the first time. Then I drew in the numbers 1 through 12 on the right-hand side of the clock, leaving the left side completely neglected, completely blank. And that to him was just the proof. This is not a psychiatric condition. There are no psychiatric conditions where you'd draw a clock like that. That just wouldn't happen. So at that point – that was his proof. This is not schizoaffective disorder. This is not a psychiatric condition. This is a neurological one. And at that point, he said, we need to do a brain biopsy because I think there's inflammation in her brain. And I need to prove that there's inflammation in her brain before I start treating her.
And there it was.
And there it was,
yeah. We should point out, by the way, you just alluded to it, that you're putting a lot of this together after the fact. You, as
yes.
a reporter, going back and doing your own story, I think you refer to it as the other person
yes.
In your book. So that was the way that was done.
Yes, I know. I had to. It was investigating everything because I didn't. Most of it is just lost to me.
Do we know what causes this?
The cause is unknown. It's still very mysterious, as are most autoimmune diseases. But I believe that there's a genetic inclination to make these bad antibodies, which are kind of the bad guys in this disease. And there has to be some kind of environmental trigger, which could be anything like from a flu virus to, you know, any number of things.
You had indicated in the book, I think, that someone just coughing near
yeah.
you could possibly be the thing that triggers all of this.
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, once they had it figured out that we were dealing with an inflammation problem here, what then?
So he did a spinal tap, and they wanted to, so he said, okay, there's inflammation in her brain, but what type of inflammation? What is causing this inflammation? That was the big mystery again. And he remembered reading this paper from out of University of Pennsylvania from a doctor named Dr. Josip Dalmau. And so he sent my spinal fluid to, at that point, the one place in the world that could test for this specific disease. And we got the results back, and I ended up having anti-NMDA receptor autoimmune encephalitis. And to treat that, he did a kind of three-prong therapy. He did high doses of steroids, intravenously given to me steroids, and then IVIG treatment and then plasmapheresis, which are basically immune therapies as well.
Yeah. The plasma was from 1,000 donors that I see at some point?
I believe it's from 1,000 donors. Yeah. I mean, the IVIG is actually, I think that one has 1,000 donors. I mean, the IVIG is actually incredibly expensive. It's about $20,000 per infusion. But it's a wonder. I mean, in my case, I think it was, I mean, the combination of the three was just so important to my recovery. And my doctor did it very swiftly. He put me on everything as quickly as he could, very high doses. And he believes that swift and aggressive intervention is what brought me back to where I am now.
Are you under any kind of medication or treatment today?
I'm not. No, I'm on nothing. Yes.
Yeah. And when did all of this conclude?
So I would say that I stopped taking any medication. I was diagnosed in April of 2009. And I probably stopped all the medication that I was on, I would say, by January, February of 2010. So about a year.
But you speak in the title, a subtitle of your book about your month of madness. Mm-hmm. That's almost a disservice to what you went through.
I kind of had a words with my – I said, shouldn't it be months? But no, I think it has a little bit of a nice sounding. But yes, it was longer than a month. The month in the hospital is kind of what I'm referring to there. Yeah.
Okay, doctor. Anything you want to add?
I do want to add one thing. So the name anti-NMDA antibody receptor disease. What that gets at is the brain communicates with neurotransmitters, and one neurotransmitter is called glutamate, and glutamate binds to receptors in the brain that recognize glutamate, and there are several of them. One of them is called NMDA. And so this disorder essentially attacks that very specific NMDA receptor, and that receptor is very much involved in learning and memory and behavior. So the fact that Susanna was amnestic for many of the symptoms is understandable because of the fact that this specific receptor system has been perturbed. Interestingly, angel dust, or PCP, as well as ketamine, street drugs, as well as therapeutic, ketamine's a therapeutic drug, blocks the same receptor. And so the symptoms that Susanna had does look like an extended version of what we used to see come in and still do to the emergency room when someone is psychotic with taking too much angel dust, for instance. So it's a fascinating connection between her symptoms and a drug like angel dust, which Susanna has never done and never should do.
No.
Because you're probably very sensitive to this.
So
I just wanted to add that because we haven't really defined what it means as an anti-NMDA receptor antibody disease. So I think the listening public might be interested in that.
That's only because I didn't want to keep saying the name of it because I obviously can't. But most fascinating. You've learned an awful lot about autoimmune problems, have you not, through all of this?
Yeah, you know, going into this, I had a basic high school biology understanding of the brain and the body. And I mean, yesterday we did an assembly series, and it was so. I find it so fascinating when Gene spoke about NMDA receptors and how vital. I mean, how vital they are to learning, memory, and behavior. And learning about what happened in my body was so important to me because I, in a way, to move past it, I needed to understand it on that very kind of biological level, and doing so legitimized my experience. No way.
But we have to take another break. We'll do that. You've just been listening to Susanna Cahalan, author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. I'm going to call it My Months of Madness just because that's what it seems like to me. She's with me in studio, as is Dr. Eugene Rubin, professor of psychiatry at Washington University. We'll come back and continue our conversation, and we'd like to get you into it at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We have a couple of calls. We'll take those when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7. KWMU. Welcome back, and if you're just joining us, my guest in studio, Susanna Cahalan, author of Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness, Dr. Eugene Rubin, professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine. And let's go to the phones. We have a number of people who want to talk to you, Susanna, and to you, doctor. We'll begin with Barbara calling from Webster Groves. Barbara, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Oh, yes, I've just been listening to your program, and Susanna, I really want to thank you for writing your book, because I too have suffered from psychosis, and I won't take a very lengthy time to go into how I am trying to avoid that 12% chance of having it return, but I just thank you so much for writing that, because it demystifies the whole process and takes the shame away from it, and also provides a lot of hope that if it does reoccur, there's another way to attack it.
Oh.
So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I think that's a really interesting point that you bring up, the whole idea of shame. And I've experienced this a lot with a lot of people I've talked to with this disease, because there's such a psychiatric presentation of the disease. I mean, I was filled with shame as well when I didn't know what was going on, or even when I didn't really understand the disease. And that was a really important thing to me when I was writing this book, was to, you know, I spoke to a woman who's from a small town in the South, and everyone in her town didn't understand what was going on with her. And she kind of she had a battle with all these people. And she said that she started just giving them my book. And in a way, she said that I couldn't verbalize it, but you could in this book. And it made her feel less alone. And in that way, that was just so incredible to hear.
Yes, and it must have been very health-giving for you too to have written it.
Oh yes, yeah. I mean, it was so cathartic.
Yeah,
Thank you so much for the call, Barbara. And Dr. Rubin, it's good for you, too, in the field that you're in, to, again, maximize the amount of understanding out there for some of the things that people experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's unfortunate that there's shame associated with any medical illnesses, including the psychiatric illnesses. And I think all of us have a long way to go to really try to eliminate the shame for being medically ill and to help us understand the nature of these illnesses so that we can help patients without them having to suffer twice with the idea of shame that somehow they're responsible for these illnesses. So a long way to go to get rid of stigma that you talked about before.
This is a little bit different, but we had a guest on the program yesterday who was talking about breast cancer and how the fact that there was a stigma associated with it until Betty Ford came out and revealed that she was being treated for that. And from that point on, it just became a totally different approach to people dealing with it, because there was a stigma attached to cancer in those days.
Right.
Same
and
thing.
I think one will notice that the stigma attached to certain illnesses, such as bipolar disorder and maybe even schizophrenia and severe depressions, are less now than they were 15 or 20 years ago, partly because of the heroism of people who do have the national eye coming out and talking about their own struggles with the disorder and that they are psychiatric medical disorders. And so the more that that occurs, the better.
And that's what you're doing right now. Congratulations for that. I'm so happy that you're here and have written this book and you've come through this as well as you have. Let's go back to the phones. Let's talk to Jean calling from St. Louis. Jean, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question or my comment comes in from the angle of seizure disorder, which I recognize is only a part of what your guest has been dealing with and the relationship to the profession of neurology. My family had a really acute interaction with neurology about 5 years ago through West Nile virus and a resulting severe case of encephalitis and then a resulting seizure disorder. And I'm wondering if the topic that you're talking about today and the way in which psychiatry and neurology are talking to each other should not also talk to a community organization like the Epilepsy Foundation. When my family was trying to make sense of the seizures that resulted from West Nile virus, it was very hard to navigate the intricacies of neurology, but the executive director of the Epilepsy Foundation here, Darla Templeton, really decoded that and demystified it and explained what was going on in a way that was very manageable. And I think anything that has to do with seizure disorder might logically connect also to the Epilepsy Foundation nationally and locally. And we have such a terrific chapter and such a terrific staff and resource here. I hope that the Washington University physicians make that connection as well.
Go ahead, Susanna.
You know, I think that that's a really good point. I think having a support structure in any way that you possibly can is so important. There is also another incredible society based in the UK. I'm actually ambassador for them, kind of. Yeah. But they're the Encephalitis Society, and they're kind of doing the same thing that the Epilepsy Society is doing, and they want to spread the word and they want to give a community to people who are suffering from this, because it can be very lonely. And, you know, luckily, because of social networking and Facebook and obviously, you know, there are actually Facebook pages devoted to this disease and autoimmune encephalitis. Mm. So people can actually share stories with one another. And I think with diseases like this, it's so important to do that.
Doctor, what about the subject of outreach, as Jean had indicated, and the need for staff at some place like the Washington University School of Medicine reaching out to some of these organizations that deal with these diseases?
I think that obviously the more education of the public, the better. Several folks are writing books for the public. There are good blogs that may help educate the public, and the different societies that are out there do wonderful jobs of peer counseling and helping educate the public. The whole area of epilepsy and seizures is fascinating, because many types of seizures are somewhat straightforward, but there are other seizures that are very complex in terms of how they show themselves and the behaviors that may be associated associated with them. And so seizures is sort of in the domain of neurology, but sometimes it edges over to psychiatry and neurology, especially when the seizures seem to be coupled with very strange, unusual behaviors, as is the case with this disorder we're talking about today. And so, again, the epilepsy societies and the St. Louis branches serve a very, very important role.
We have an email from Jill in St. Louis. My fiancé was diagnosed with schizophrenia nearly 10 years ago. His diagnosis has since been changed to schizoaffective. He often describes the back of his head as being hot when his symptoms are flaring. A question for the doctor. How similar might this be to what Emily is describing on the Emily, I think she probably means Susanna, is describing on the physiological level?
Excellent question, and the answer is we don't know. Most people who have an illness that looks like schizophrenia or looks like schizoaffective disorder have that illness, and the cause of that illness isn't this rare illness that Susanna has had. But the symptoms of strange feelings that influence a person and their behavior, the causes of those symptoms, the way the brain malfunctions may be somewhat similar. We just have a lot more to learn about that.
We have another email. It's unsigned. It says, "This book may save lives." Do you think that's too strong a statement,
wow,
Susanna?
Well, I mean, thank you. I don't know about this book saving lives. I think the people who read it and learn from it might. I'm not saving a life. A physician who's catching this is saving a life. But I think that spreading the awareness is so important, and spreading the awareness about this disease, and also, as you were just saying, rekindling interest in studying psychiatric conditions and trying to find that cause, I think all sorts of awareness that are presented can help people. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily my book itself. I think it's...
I think Susanna's being too modest. I think this book will help save lives, because the illness that she's describing is becoming better recognized. Unrecognized and untreated, a certain percentage, 10% or so, die from this illness. And if treated, much fewer people die from this disorder. So the more this disorder is recognized, even though it's rare, there will be some people who it will be recognized, treated, and they will get somewhat, a lot, or fully better from it. And that's the definition of saving lives, if you ask me.
Did you feel during this, or were you aware enough of what was going on to feel that your life was imperiled?
That's an interesting question. I think I never stared death in the face in any real way. I think my parents did.
Yeah.
I think they probably wouldn't admit it now. My mom in a lot of ways always says, "Oh, it wasn't that bad," because I think that's her way of coping. But I think at the time they were very, very aware of their own mortality too. I think it was a very scary time. I was not cognizant enough to have that kind of abstract thought.
Yeah.
I don't think.
One of the emailers, I think the last one we mentioned, talked about feeling heat in the head. We're talking inflammation.
Yes.
And we had a caller who didn't stay. Is this something you feel? Is your head hotter?
No. I've actually been asked that question several times. No, it's a figure of speech. I mean, I had migraines, which can sometimes feel like flashes of heat, but my head did not feel hot to the touch or feel hot. No.
We have another email here, unsigned. It's lengthy. I'll read this portion of it. What can a patient say or do to encourage communication between providers, or insist that more be done when, quote, the experts insist that the problem is something else entirely? For instance, your author's famous neurologist who diagnosed her as partying too much.
Right. Yeah, I think for me, again, this is more of a question for my parents, because they were the ones who were advocating for me. But having that support system in place, being brave enough in a way, courageous enough to question doctors. And I think that's important. I think that doctors do need to be, they're human beings. They need to be questioned. They're not, just because you have a white lab coat on doesn't mean that you know everything. And I know that, you know, my mom in particular, she was dogged in her determination to, she wrote down every word that they said and looked it up on the internet and tried to make sense of what was going on. Because sometimes, a lot of times, especially specialists will speak above you, and they don't necessarily mean to, but it's just, they just, you know, they just do. And between all the, you know, the emotional support and then the actual dogged, you know, determination to kind of get that right answer and not taking one, you know, diagnosis as fact. You know, I think that was what led me there.
Is this a good thing to be looking up medical issues on the internet, doctor? I've heard both ways on that.
Yes, I think having an educated patient is wonderful. I think that when something doesn't make sense at all to a patient or their families, it's always a good idea to consider a second opinion. Mm-hmm. When the doctor comes across as a person who isn't considering different options, for instance, saying this was all related to alcohol, an alcohol withdrawal when she was with her mom for a long period of time, weeks, I believe, a week or two, mm-hmm. without drinking at all, then one might want to consider getting an opinion from another physician. Now, looking up stuff on the internet, sometimes we have patients who come in who are very knowledgeable and who contribute and negotiate and partner with their doctor for care, which is great. At other times, we have patients coming in demanding a certain medication or a drug that's a very expensive drug that's unnecessary and could be dangerous. And so we need to spend our time trying to teach and work with them so that they are better able to understand what we're trying to say. And that sometimes takes a long period of time. And so, as you said, it can be both a blessing and a curse depending mm-hmm. on how it's handled.
Susanna, you'd mentioned earlier that you had about $1 million worth of tests
yes.
and treatment. Insurance pay for that?
Yes. Yeah, I was so lucky because I was full-time at my newspaper and had incredible insurance.
But you're no longer with the newspaper. You're freelancing, is that correct?
I'm still with them. I'm a freelancer there, but I still do write for them, yes.
And do you still have medical insurance through the Post?
I have very bad medical insurance, but not through the Post anymore. No, I pay for my own.
Uh-huh. How much are you spending after having gone through all of this, if I may be so bold?
Per month?
Yeah.
I have very limited health. I shouldn't. I should probably find better health insurance, but about $400 a month.
Well, and that's with this pre-existing condition, and that's not very good, you say. Limited time left, but Susanna, what did you learn about yourself through all of this?
You know, one word kept coming up during my interviews with people. I had this kind of Tom Sawyer at his own funeral experience when I was interviewing family and friends about myself. Enthusiastic. That word kept coming up as a way to, you know, how would you define me? Enthusiastic. That was a word. And I never really knew that that was so much part of my personality until almost losing my personality completely.
Enthusiastic about what?
Life. You know, they seem to just say that that was just a word that just kept coming up in a way to describe me.
Doctor, that seems like a pretty good word for anyone to have with regard to looking at life and looking ahead.
It is. Unfortunately, people have different personalities. Some people's personalities are by nature enthusiastic, and other people's personalities are a little bit different. And I think we have to accept the normalcy to allow for all kinds of personalities. But if one can have an enthusiastic personality, that's great.
And everybody in the family, the friends, the boyfriend, everybody, as indicated earlier, just delighted to have you back.
And I'm delighted to be back, I'll tell you.
No doubt. That's Susanna Cahalan. She is the author of the book Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. She's been with us in studio, and I'll repeat once again that she'll be appearing at Left Bank Books on Euclid in the Central West End Wednesday at 7 o'clock. She'll discuss and sign her book. As I indicated, it is Brain on Fire, My Month of Madness. Also with me in studio has been Dr. Eugene Rubin, professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine. Anybody want to have a final word? We've got 15 seconds. Left.
Thank you so much for having us. This was excellent.
Great to have you.
And thank you, too.
Thank you for being with us. And keep up the book tour. Obviously, you're doing a lot of good, and maybe, in fact, you are helping to save lives. Thank you so much. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Post-Dispatch photographer J.B. Forbes and reporter Jesse Bogan about their work documenting the war in Afghanistan as they were embedded with a Missouri National Guard unit just back recently from that trip. They will be with us in studios, and we'll have a full array of photos shot by Mr. Forbes on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.